So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. Well, hello and welcome back to the show. Today, I am joined by Anna Cusack, a postnatal doula, motherhood studies practitioner, and author of a fantastic book called Mama, You're Not Broken, Unmasking the Unspoken Emotions of Modern Motherhood. It is a great book in which Anna speaks honestly and powerfully about the emotional load of modern motherhood. And she writes from a place of personal experience too, having experienced postnatal anxiety in her own mental health journey following the birth of her own children. Anna lives in Australia, and she's been alcohol-free for nearly 7 years. And together we're going to be unpicking why so many mums feel like they're not coping and how alcohol has been positioned as the default release valve. But listen, you know, to be honest, whatever stage of life you're in, if you've ever felt alone, exhausted, or quietly disconnected from yourself, I can promise you this conversation is going to be a good one. So welcome to the show, Anna.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh no, the pleasure is all mine. I've read your book. I've read your book. I've loved your book. I've quoted your book. I've used your book. it's never far from me when I'm coaching and talking to young mums myself. So I always ask this before we dive into general conversation: is there anything you would like to add to that intro? Have I done you any disservice, or have I left anything out?
No, not at all a disservice. I will say that I, before I became a parent, I had a background in allied health and worked for a number of years in physical rehab. So this transition to sort of emotional and practical support has been quite organic one. And also that I am here on the lens of the Awabakal people, mm-hmm. which is important for me to say because that land was never ceded.
Brilliant. Well, we're going to dig into all of this. Now, I have a couple of questions to start with, just for context. Mm. First of all, in your words, do you want to explain what a doula does?
Most people have heard of a doula, who have heard of a doula, hear of them in the sense of supporting people through birth. They will attend the hospital or whichever birthing environment people are at, supporting them through the pregnancy and the birth planning process, and then providing emotional support and whatever is needed through the actual birth. My work is more so in the postnatal space. So I provide, again, emotional support either in a group setting or in home, and do all of those things that may have been done by other members of the community previously. Mm-hmm. So that could be basic things like meal preparation and dishes, but it could also be connecting with some of the professional services that are needed. And so it can be up to me to be able to recognize what is normal and what's not, mm-hmm. For both the mother and parents and the baby, and then to be able to refer to more specialized support services. So that might be a pelvic floor physiotherapist, or it could be noticing some things that might be helped by psychology, or supporting people either calling in community through various community building strategies, or helping them set boundaries when people who are trying to be helpful are actually being more of a hindrance than a help.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic services. So, no, I wanted you to clarify that distinction, really, because I think most people have probably heard about doulas in the context of birth.
Yeah, and there are, I'm not sure about where you are, but in our area there are people who provide what they term full spectrum care. So that can be from conception and pregnancy support right through the birth and through the postnatal time period as well. I am not in a phase of life where I can be on call for a birth. My children are 2.5 and 6, so there's no way that I can be leaving them at the drop of a hat to go and attend a birth. So my focus is on the postnatal time, yeah.
Well, it's vital focus, as we're about to talk about. And thank you for giving us a context of your children's age, because that was my very next question. Obviously, you're still still a mum of young children yourself. Yeah, well, still fresh. I mean, we were talking at the beginning of this recording, weren't we? We delayed a few minutes because your 2.5-year-old was kicking off as is her.
Yeah, right. We're in that awkward, sometimes napping, sometimes not, can never quite pick where bedtime is.
Yep, yeah. never pin it down, and always doing the opposite to what you want. No, I get that.
I think they can sense when there's something that you need to do, and that's
they totally can. They've got that sixth sense of whatever you're wanting them to do at that point in time, they want to do the opposite. So, yeah, I get that.
It can feel like that, yeah.
So what was your, you obviously, you know, mention on your website, and I've listened to you talk in various contexts, and you talk about your own mental health journey around birth. Giving us a top line, Anna, what sort of led you to write this book in a way? Because it does open up the kind of honest, raw and sometimes messy stuff around motherhood in a big way. It's certainly not the highlight reel of motherhood that we often see.
No, you get the highlight reel everywhere else, but you don't get this version as much.
No,
sometimes
exactly.
You get it in the form of memoirs. Yeah. Motherhood memoirs often cover a lot of this stuff, but not in the way that it's written in this book.
Yeah, which it opens the door to lots of unspoken truths. And when I read it for the first time, it was obvious to me that the only person who could write it would be someone who's experienced that side of it too. So tell us a little bit about your background there.
Yeah, so before I had children, have experience with both depression and anxiety. And although I was very mentally well through my pregnancy, and I did a lot of preparation for the postnatal period, which most people having babies for the first time don't, because we're not really made aware of just what the reality of life with the new baby is going to be. And with a history of postnatal depression in my family line, I wanted to do everything that I could to be supported and well during that time. So there were various books and podcasts and resources that I used to make sure that I had a really strong web of support around me, and what's called the fourth trimester period, so the 3 months after birth. And I had a dream birth and a dream fourth trimester. And then at 4 months postpartum, when the reality of my unputdownable baby kicked in and sleep hating and all of those things, I found myself feeling very, very anxious. Mm-hmm. And luckily had the resources to access counselling quite swiftly, but it still was a while to, you know, claw out of that situation. And then, you know, as the world feels, sometimes it just feels gradually like you're getting a little bit more space or a little more back to whatever you feel is yourself or the part of your identity outside of motherhood. I was set to return to work and I got 2 shifts in, and then the pandemic came along and everything, again, that anxiety really kicked in. I was working in a hospital setting. We really didn't know at that point in time what COVID was and what it was about. And I ended up having a big freak out and going on leave, and ended up I didn't go back to that job at all after that. So I spent the next while, I'd already done my postpartum doula training during that maternity leave time, and then I continued to do additional training. And probably the most influential before writing that book was the Motherhood Studies Practitioner course with Dr. Sophie Brock, who's a sociologist specializing in motherhood studies. And it really helped to provide clarity around my own experience. And I just was having the same conversations with other people over and over. I'd begun writing a blog and having I had a podcast after a while as well. And I just felt like that anything that I was writing or posting on social media or whatever, it would just keep going to the bottom of the pile. You know, like when you make something, if you make a new post, the post the next day just pushes that one off and it gets lost and no one sees it. But a book is something that it takes a lot of time, a lot of research, a lot of thought, a lot of editing to really be happy with it and have something that you are proud enough of to know that it's going to be shared around and not fall out of people's view. And I felt that the way that my brain works, the background that I had in health, this training that I'd done, and the people who I had to draw upon and lean on, I could put something really meaningful together. So what I ended up doing was writing Mummy, You're Not Broken, and it's divided into 10 chapters, and each chapter covers a specific emotion. So the first one is guilt, because that's a massive one for mums. That's the place to start. Mm-hmm. And then covers a lot of things, uncertainty, fear, anger, overwhelm, grief, boredom's in there.
Absolutely.
And even contentment too, because sometimes if everyone else around you is having a hard time or you feel like perhaps you're not living up to the potential that you were told that you had, it can feel really strange to admit that you're contented. So it's nice to get to that place. It happens occasionally, not very often. But when it does, that can be tricky to talk about too. So, yeah, that's the book in a nutshell.
Oh, thank you for that. There's so much in what you've just said. I'm not even going to be able to double back and talk about all of it, but a few things that really struck me. I relate to that fourth trimester so much. I think I sometimes sort of talk a little bit glibly about, you know, people who say, oh, my baby sleeps so well. You say, how old are they? And they go, 9 weeks. And you're like, yeah, of course I do. Yeah. You know, it's that sense of you almost get lulled into this false sense of security, don't you? That first.
Oh, well, I didn't like that one. She just never slept from the start.
Oh, never. So. Okay. She came out and started as she intended to go on. But I kind of look back on both of my daughters in a very young stage of life, and I relate in a way to that honeymoon period where you bring them home and you kind of go, this is quite easy, actually, in a way, you know, it's sort of challenging.
Like carrying Paris Hilton's little dog around in the handbag. Like they're still portable.
They're still very portable and they sleep an awful lot. And you'll sort of go, I've got this nailed. And you just think, oh, no, just wait. So that, yeah, I really relate to that. Also, something that I just hadn't thought about, which is so bloody obvious when you think about it now, mums of toddler age children were pregnant during the pandemic, which must have been an altogether different layer of isolation and uncertainty, fear, anxiety, having got all the responsibilities of bringing a young baby into the world. You're kind of going, what kind of a bloody world is this? That just hadn't occurred to me, the impact that could also have.
A lot of fear.
Mm.
And then for a lot of people, a lot of trauma. They had to choose, at least where I am, just one person to attend the birth with them. And so a lot of women felt that they had to ask the father to be their husband, their partner, when the person that they really perhaps wanted was their mum, or the person that would have helped them navigate the system was their doula, but they couldn't have them. And it's made for quite a difficult postnatal journey for a lot of them.
Right from the get-go, that would, you know, the idyllic, you know, birth plan, the idyllic way that this was going to happen just didn't. That was, and I imagine that, you know, there's a feeling of being robbed through all of that as well, to a degree.
On the flip side of that, there were some aspects where many women and people who were breastfeeding said that actually not having any visitors for the first few weeks made that process much easier. They learned how to be a family instead of having to host people.
Oh, yes.
And so, it goes both ways. But again, it's one of those situations where the people who are most disadvantaged are the ones who get hit the hardest. So, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right to point out the flip side as well. But as you say, those who are most disadvantaged are often the ones who get most hit in those moments. And so your book, Anna, the sort of subtitle to it, is, as you say, is Unmasking the Unspoken Emotions of Modern Motherhood. Why do you think there is so much silence around these emotions? It's a big question though, isn't it? But
yeah, well, I think there are multiple answers. So one very glaring one is that if you talk about it, then you're perceived as being ungrateful or incompetent, not a good mum in some way. And there are so many pressures that we have unknowingly internalized, and we can feel fearful that we are presenting to others as a failure, but also feel like if you speak those things, it makes it real. And if you don't say it, then you can pretend to yourself that it's not happening too. Or it might just be shame, guilt and shame. Why aren't I keeping up with everybody else? But the reality is that no one's really keeping up because it's just a facade.
Yeah, yeah. And to what degree, because I can't help personally thinking that this is a factor as well. I mean, I'm 54. When I had my children, I was 36 and 39 respectively. But I had never really heard my mother's version of events. She being of a generation, particularly in the UK, I don't know if it's different in Australia, I don't suppose it is, where emotions and, you know, poor or negative emotion experiences were sort of brushed under the carpet as well. So there wasn't an open conversation. My mum never said to me, I had a terrible time in motherhood. I don't know whether she, to this day, I don't know whether she did or she didn't. But because it's not spoken, that's the sort of the legacy in many ways.
And we do forget what it's like to, once you're past that stage, it is easier to look back with rose-coloured glasses too. And I don't know that people are being, you know, I don't think anyone's being rude when they come up to a new mum in the supermarket and say, enjoy it, it goes so fast, or these are the best days of your life. I don't think anybody's trying to rub it in, but I think they do honestly forget how hard it is.
Yeah.
They don't forget what it's like to be on call 24/7 and not getting more than 40 minutes of sleep at a time for literally weeks and months. It's hard, and it does get forgotten, and you remember the nicer bits often, unless it was a really, you know, unless you were absolutely in the pits. And there again, they're not the people that come up and tell you. You don't get somebody coming up to you in the supermarket and saying, I wanted to commit suicide when I had a child. They're not the people that come up and talk to you.
No, definitely not. But I won't talk about my own experience at length because I've done that on this podcast so many times. But I remember feeling, I mean, as I went through your book and I was like, yes, you know, guilt, shame, anger, grief, boredom. I'm like, tick, 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 tick. Yeah. You know, I was literally, the shame thing I think was huge because it's almost a result of all the other things. It's, you know, how can I feel like this? How can I feel anger, grief, guilt, etc. at a time in my life when I'm supposed to be feeling so joyful? How can I be craving time on my own when I should be rejoicing in the time spent immersed in motherhood? How can I be, you know, wishing for my former freedoms when this is what every woman craves? And, you know,
supposedly, yeah.
supposedly.
Yeah. I think it's especially hard when there has either been a history of loss or a long fertility journey, that you finally get the baby in your arms that you wanted, and then you want to run away sometimes, and yes, that would be a huge mind game. It'd be very difficult to be with that emotional storm.
I can see that. Again, I knew this conversation was going to be like this. Lots of things I hadn't considered before, but yeah, particularly when the emotional investment and the desire to reach that stage in life has been so huge. And then you feel these, yes.
Yeah, it's felt that. Like what will be the pinnacle of happiness.
Mm.
And then it's often not. Or it is and it's not at the same time. It's very difficult.
It is. It's that conflict. I think it's that huge conflict. And what we're talking fundamentally about, isn't it, is that sort of disconnect between the myth of motherhood.
Yeah.
And the idealized version of motherhood, and then the stark realities. So yeah, really, really challenging.
I think a lot of that's been built up through the media as well. You know, the mother that's always calm. We have an awareness of things like attachment theory, where the child needs, you know, stable, responsive figures in their life. And if you've done 99 good things for the day, and then you yell, you're going to tie yourself up in knots about that one thing.
Oh my God, that was me, 100%. You know, and because we, as with all things in life, we never, ever stop to congratulate ourselves, or, you know, our brain is tilted towards the things that we've either perceived ourselves to have failed to do or not quite got to. It's that, never quite giving ourselves credit where credit is due. So Anna, listen, this is obviously the big drink rethink. I've got to bring the conversation around to alcohol. Otherwise, listeners are going to be like, what the hell? So I have talked at length about the fact that my own drinking ramped up during motherhood. Despite my best intentions, I sort of swanned off into maternity leave after a period of obvious sobriety during pregnancy. I swanned off into maternity leave, new chapter of life, new me. I was going to have this nailed. I was going to be that picture of serene, calm.
You were going to be the real estate ad mom.
I was. And I totally was. And within 3 months, I was drinking like a fish, very, very much because I realize now that that had been my coping mechanism in life all the way up to motherhood. So why was it going to change? I didn't have any new tools, and I hadn't really appreciated the emotional tsunami that was about to hit. So my drinking ramped up during motherhood. First of all, in your experience, is this a pattern that you see a lot?
I'm not sure that it's a pattern that I see super often within my context and my circles. I think it is a common pattern, but perhaps not one that I personally see so much. So in Australia, we have one of the highest rates of breastfeeding initiation in the world. So 96% of mothers initiate breastfeeding. And the rate of either breastfeeding or exclusive breastfeeding does drop off at each sort of checkpoint, 3 months, yeah. 4 months, six sure. months, 9 months. But there is a longer period of time here than in the UK where people are committed to, I don't want to say committed to trying, because it's just really hard to do. Breastfeeding is not just something that comes naturally and you just do it. It's hard work. And you and the baby are both learning every time, every new baby, it's all new again. But I think that's, yeah, perhaps people who are in my circles are more likely to be what's called feeding on demand, which is looking for the baby's cues when they're hungry rather than breastfeeding based or bottle feeding based on the clock. And when the baby is feeding very frequently, which is what happens early because their tummies are tiny, there's not really a set gap that you know that you can have a drink and then it'll be out of your milk and your system by the time they feed. And so perhaps that comes back in more when people start to introduce formula. But most of the people that come to my work and that I work with are quite committed to giving everything they've got into breastfeeding. So within my clients directly, I don't see that early flow into alcohol, but I know that as a trend, there is plenty of data from Australia that shows that every birthday the baby has, there are more mothers who are drinking and drinking to unsafe levels. And that by the time the youngest child is five, that the rates of unsafe drinking are the same as they were pre-pregnancy. So I think it is sort of like coming out of that very early period. I think it does come back more and more.
I've got to caveat this by saying, you know, I've learned that I can't feel ashamed about this. This is just the way it was for me. But given what you said, you might be slightly horrified that I got to 3 months, I think, breastfeeding both of mine, and thought, okay, I've set them up well. But now I was beginning to, I suppose, time and schedule feeding such that I could prepare, I could pre-pump, I could make sure that those bottles were ready, but I could also drink. So looking back, there's no doubt whatsoever that I was beginning to impose a routine onto my babies that suited me and my drinking. There's no doubt about that. And that awful wasteful pump and dump as well, where you might have gone out the night before and then this precious resource that you're producing as a woman has to be dumped.
Yeah, you're getting doubly dehydrated there, aren't you?
I mean, there's no part of that practice that feels great, believe me, but it happened. And I just started to lean more and more on alcohol as a coping mechanism, and therefore that was all part of my coping mechanism dynamic, I suppose.
Yeah. And please don't feel any judgment from me in this conversation and what I'm saying. And everybody's got their own path and journey, and we need to recognize as well the influence of culture, which you've talked about so much on your podcast. But also even things like through the 70s, women in the UK who stayed in, I don't know if it's all hospitals, but some hospitals, they would stay 10 days after birth, and every evening they were brought a drink because it was meant to be, you know, refueling their stores and nourishing them. And before that, people were advised to drink a Guinness every day in pregnancy because that would boost their iron levels.
Yeah.
And then this is where we have the data from.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
I'd literally forgotten that.
And then in the 60s, the 60s as well, there's a whole lot of marketing around Mother's Little Helper, which is Valium, and it was hugely overprescribed to mothers. And now we want this calm mother to exist with none of these basically pharmaceutical or synthetic supports without changing any of the structural things. If anything, those structural pressures have increased. So it's really unfair.
I was going to say, if anything, they've increased. That's a massive wake up, isn't it? Because I suppose as we talk about the mummy wine culture today as being alive and kicking, and so much, you know, perpetrated by the marketing business, obviously, sort of looking for occasions and frequency of consumption, the pinking of the wine market and the vulnerability of women at that stage in life. But actually, it existed before, not necessarily so much through the marketing side of things, but almost in hospitals with the coping mechanisms, the Valium, the, you know, the Guinness and stuff. It's I had literally forgotten that. So we talk about structurally, you know, things are pressurized out there for mum, and things haven't necessarily changed. What kind of support would actually shift things, do you think, for mums in your work as a doula and motherhood mentor? What do you find mums are really craving? We answer it with a drink. We answer it with, you know, those sort of more pharmaceutical type of responses. But what do you feel is underneath the need?
A higher adult to child ratio most of the time. Extra hands. Extra people who love their children as much as they do, so they don't feel that they are always the default person. Because there is this unspoken pressure that if you're the one who has given birth, it really feels like everybody else can escape except for you.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And it is completely not how humans have operated for thousands and thousands of years. And it makes it really difficult to enjoy our children if we are the only person responsible for meeting their needs the vast majority of the time. So it's not necessarily possible to say what we need is for everybody to live in a commune or what we need is for the fall of capitalism. But those things both would help a lot to bolster maternal and parental mental health, because father's mental health is really inextricably linked to maternal mental health too.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But mostly, yeah, we want an more adult to child ratio, and basically we want community. If we want to be able to enjoy our kids and not be falling apart, we need people around us to be having little conversations on the go and, you know, eye contact with somebody else. If you're somebody who likes eye contact, obviously some neurodivergent people do not, and you know, people in general may not like that, but sometimes just like a knowing look with someone and an understanding in joke, or being able to look at someone and roll your eyes, those sorts of things are actually really helpful in getting through the day.
I couldn't agree more. I'm just thinking about my own experience. I was very lucky in the sense that I went back to work. So in itself, I had a dilution of my day in a way. I returned to a career, and for want of a better term, it was possibly a sort of a dilution or a distraction. However, it came at a cost, because we had to pay for childcare support. We had help, and we were fortunate enough to be able to afford that. Now, I remember lots of people saying to me at the time, why do you want someone else looking after your baby? Why would you go back to work simply to pay for someone else to look after your baby? And I can remember thinking, because I will go insane.
Yeah.
If I don't. And also, and to pick up on a point that you just made, which I feel really strongly about, choosing the right person and building the right support network means that there are more people in my daughter's lives that loved them and cared for them. And it wasn't just me and my husband. I lived, you know, a slight distance from my mum, so it couldn't be that traditional family closing in and providing the support. But I didn't feel...
It's the idea of building a village, and the professional supports become some of your village.
Absolutely.
And if it's quality childcare and they're getting that responsiveness and love and support and nurture from someone else, that's great. That's excellent.
Isn't it?
High quality childcare is a really important thing.
But it's so expensive, Anna.
Yeah.
It's expensive here in the UK. I'm assuming it's, like, in an idealized world, there would be much more provided, there would be much more infrastructure, there'd much be much more sort of free community support. And there are, you know, there are walk-in centers and community support and clubs and things that mothers can go to, but there isn't an awful lot, I would say, intentionally provided by the healthcare system. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know whether it necessarily needs to be the healthcare system, but you know, you've definitely got to go looking for it. And that the sort of the higher end childcare support that I was talking about is very spendy indeed.
Yeah, it cuts a lot of people out from accessing the help that they need.
Yeah.
So I think higher quality childcare that is freely available is great. As in completely government subsidised, I would happily pay more taxes to make sure that everybody who needs to access high quality childcare can do that. But I also believe that people who stay home with their children should be given the same amount of funding as what would otherwise be subsidised to that childcare centre. Because if you only provide free childcare, then the expectation is going to be that every mother, every parent, needs to go back to work and costs will just hike up somewhere else. And in Australia, the most common setup is to have sort of 1.5 incomes, and that it's really, really hard to get by on 1.5 incomes at the moment. It's already pushing up. More and more people are having to go back to work before they feel ready. It sounds like it was your choice to go back to work, and I absolutely support that. I do often speak with people who are really upset about returning to work before they want to, because sure. it needs to be done for a financial reason. So I think there should be both of those things. That would be my ideal setup.
I had a full year off following each birth, and I took as much maternity leave as I was able to and could afford to, and you know, from an employee perspective was going to be granted mm-hmm. to me before it was questions as to whether I was ever going to go back. So I took all that I could, but definitely, yes, it was definitely an intentional choice for me to go back to work, and an intentional choice to surround or to bring in some childcare. And of all the things that I felt guilty around when I was a young mum, bringing someone else into my daughter's lives to sort of look after them and care for them and love them wasn't actually one of the things I felt guilty about. But I think what you've just talked about in terms of it really struck me, we were never supposed to bring children up in isolation. We were, you know, that's not the way it's ever been. It's not, you know, looking historically, primitively.
Yeah, it's a real side effect of industrialization.
Because you can look at other cultures as well. And I'm going to make a broad sweeping statement here, but in some cultures, you know, as soon as children enter the family unit, everybody closes in. You know, you even move back home when you're married. You make sure that infrastructure is in place. And then it's a very multi-generational exercise, which is wonderful. It could drive some people bonkers, obviously, but it could also provide the sort of scaffolding and community that's much needed. So the community aspect of it, and it really struck me that what you said was you stop feeling like you're solely responsible, because I think that feeling of sole responsibility, it's such a weight and it's such a burden. And for me, even within that sort of year of maternity leave that I did take off, it set me off into some kind of, I became a sort of over-functioning, over-striving, terribly, terribly strong taskmaster against myself. And I suppose that sort of many hands make light work proverb takes away that sense of potential over-functioning and stress that we put ourselves under.
Yeah, certainly. I think also that it takes a lot of countercultural kind of work within ourselves to realize that a lot of the things that we are trying to do are actually just not important.
Yes.
And to drop expectations. And yeah, it can be great to have somebody to come over, and if they're happy to do a cleanup of the lounge room while they're there, that's excellent. But also, if there's no one come over, the lounge room can wait till another time. And so long as you and your family make it through till the next day, then that's a win. And when you've come from a different set of ways of marking your achievements for the day, when, you know, we live in such a productivity, striving, external, aspirational, achievement-based, individualistic culture, and it takes a real shift.
How do we let that go? Because when I coach clients of a completely different demographic, actually, not mums of young children or new mums, but any stage in life, one of the very, very strong dynamics that sits below drinking is a sort of a perfectionism. And I very often end up working with clients to sort of dig into what are the unhelpful expectations that you have in life. And that can be of life, but it can also be of yourself in life. Where do they come from? Who set them? Invariably ourselves. How are we measuring success? How are we measuring achievement? Why do we always measure the gap and not progress? You know, all these kind of unhelpful thought patterns that we get into. But obviously in motherhood, you can almost, you know, put a fire under that and say, you know, you're in hyperdrive again, because all these assumptions of how motherhood is supposed to look versus, you know, your lived reality of it. And I certainly know that as a young mum, I genuinely wanted to be doing things brilliantly, but I also wanted to be seen to be doing things brilliantly. I wanted to look accomplished, buttoned down, well-groomed, you know, I wanted to look like I was nailing it because I believed everybody else was. But how do you let go of that?
Everybody else at their best time of the day. Because when you go to the park or when you go to the cafe or the library or the shops, that's when everybody else is already out of the house and they're just doing the activity that they're there to do. They're not trying to make snacks and stop the toddler knocking over the big kid stuff and feed the baby all at the same time. Mm. They've done all the difficult getting out of the house part and they've left all the mess behind for that hour or two and they're just on the chill out part. And you think that's how they operate all the time, but they don't.
No. I think that said, obviously, they don't. And even on social media, we see a very edited, you know, positively edited version of, but we would still be greatly benefited from being able to let go of the myth of this sort of pleasantly perfect and self-sacrificing mother. How do we begin to do that, do you think?
There's an activity that I mentioned Dr. Sophie Brock, the sociologist, before. There's an activity that she ran myself and another group through at some point, which I have used with my own clients in the past. And we sit around in a group or in an online setting and we start to brainstorm a list of all of the things that we think a good mother should be. Mm-hmm. And invariably, the first thing that people say is, you know, calm, cool, calm and collected, never yells. But then we start going into, okay, so what does she look like? What's she wearing? What body size is she? Who's in her family? Where do they live? Does she work or not work? What do her children eat? How do they spend their time? And when you start to lay out all of those expectations, you can see actually what a load of bollocks it is. And also see that even if you fix in inverted commas, the thing about yourself that you think needs fixing, you're still never going to tick every box because the perfect mother is imaginary. And it can be freeing to see that A, imaginary doesn't exist, and B, that even if you fix the thing you're trying to do, you're never going to live up to it anyway. So you might as well find your own way and see what your own children need of you, because they all need something different. And that can be a really powerful activity. It can also be really helpful to start going, well, whose approval am I looking for?
Yes.
And if the approval is anybody else's approval other than your own and your kids' approval, it's probably not important right now. It's not really relevant. I'm not a psychologist or a counselor, so that's not necessarily my role to really dig into that kind of thing. But if we're trying to, you know, if we're trying to tick every box to fill some void because we never got the approval of our mother or whoever else it is that was important that we wanted to get love from but didn't, you can do every single thing and it's not going to change that. So it's often about identifying and addressing wounds that exist within ourselves to be able to go, well, this isn't a useful thought loop to be on. And just learning to sit still, it's really, really difficult to learn that. And when you have a tiny baby, you are like, you're on the go all the time, but there's also a lot of sitting down, either feeding or holding a baby that's asleep or whatever. And one of the most helpful things that I did, and I didn't expect it to be, I went to a week-long yoga course and I was, you know, very fidgety and standing up the back and moving and stretching, and by the end of the week I could sit down and listen to what the teacher was saying for like 4 hours or so, and I've never been able to sit still in my life and, you know, open the door to meditation and whatever else, and I really don't get a chance to do that anymore, but it certainly was something that I realized that I needed to learn and practice, was just to learn how to sit and not do stuff.
Yeah.
And it served me really well.
It's so powerful. It's so important. I've talked several times before about when we have that 5 minutes, that elusive 5, 10, 15 minutes as young mums, our inclination is to do stuff for us, for ourselves, or to have a drink, you know, particularly in the evening. It's like, oh, to have a drink. And actually that blocks the feelings that you want to and need to feel. It blocks the signals coming from yourself that tell you what you need in that moment. And invariably it's not a drink, it's to relax or to sit still or to sort of listen to your body. What do I need right now? What would serve me right now?
Yeah. I feel that when you are caring for children, you're operating at such a fast pace, even if that fast pace is within your mind. Mm. You are paying attention and adapting all of the time and making a lot of decisions, and that's tiring. And there needs to be something in between stress and relaxation. It doesn't flick on a switch like that. And I see why alcohol and, you know, that wine culture bit of, you know, mummy needs wine to relax, which I don't subscribe to, but it's clever marketing, isn't it? Because it's a ritual that it's the thing that may help flick that switch for some people. But it may very likely be not the thing that you actually need. It could be that if you have a partner who gets home and you thrust the baby at them and walk out the door and go and sit in the car and just like scream at nothing for a minute. Or it could be making a cup of tea, or it could be having a shower or going for a walk around the block and calling a friend.
Or having a nap.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's so many things. Yeah.
That's how I got through the first non-sleeping baby, was that I knew that she wasn't going to sleep well overnight, and I had never been able to nap before, and I trained myself to sleep between 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. every night so that I could get through the actual night awake with her by listening to the same meditation on an app every time. And I knew it so well that my brain would get bored and my body was tired enough, so I fell asleep. And we did that for years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that was the only time that I would have available with a known caregiver every day.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And made it happen. So there are things that you probably can make a routine of in that time that are not always a drink, that will help be your cue. You know, they talk about like sleep cues for babies and for adults. It's the same kind of thing, a relaxation cue. You've just gone from, if you have been the one doing individual one, you know, the only one with kids care, then that might be the thing. It could be if you're, you know, if you are working and you've got your commute home, that, I don't know, having an e-book on your phone, yep, or your or device or whatever, yep, like read one chapter and that's the thing. Or I don't know, there are various options that could be the thing that work for you.
Well, you've answered my very final question to you, really, which was, if someone's listening right now thinking, you know, wine glass in hand, what would you suggest instead? And I guess it's any of those above things, discovering what works for you, but just really thinking through, what do you need? Because it's hardly ever going to be a drink. It's going to be another aspect of self-care or time spent fulfilling your own requirements.
Yeah. And it might not be what do you need at that moment. It's what do you need in future days to have enough community care that you don't feel like this by this point.
Yes, that's the sort of proactive, intentional.
So how can you spend time with others who will build you up rather than drain you? Yes. Because, like, it is easier being, you know, I said an adult-to-child ratio, but it's often easier being two adults with four or five kids than it is being one adult with one or two kids.
Yeah. That does feel very familiar. I totally get that. We used to say that, you know, when I was in maternity leave, there were a few of us who would take it in turns. That would say three of us, and between us, we had six children, would say, well, two of us will take the six children.
Yep.
And the other mum gets a day off, literally gets to go off and do something for the day. It was just a little rota of treats.
A friend and I did one, like a 3-hour block a week where we where we shared paying for a babysitter. Yeah. So we knew that we would have just like that set aside time before before the kids had started daycare and preschool and whatever else, that we knew that we would have time, because I'm sure this situation is familiar with lots of people listening. I have a partner who sometimes is working nights and is often away 4 or 5 nights at a time. And it's a long stretch if you are not definite that you're going to have someone else there. Yeah. And it's beautiful to have family support and to build up your community and do your village and whatever else. But also the people who are paid are the ones who are least likely to pull out at the last minute.
Yeah.
Sometimes the paid help can be very, very helpful. I would also say that if somebody is listening with a wine glass in hand and wondering or thinking that reducing or stopping alcohol is something that they might want to do, that they probably know the answer already. They probably know.
Yeah.
If you think that alcohol is something that is not helping you and not serving you anymore, or you're thinking maybe, then you probably know the answer already.
Brilliant advice. Anna, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on to the show. This is the end of your day because you're obviously recording in Australia and I'm in the UK. So beginning of my day, end of yours. So I'm even more grateful. I know it's a sort of tricky time of day for you. So thank you so much indeed. Your book, again, Mama, You're Not Broken, Unmasking the Unspoken Emotions of Modern Motherhood, is brilliant. I can't plug it enough. And I will put a link to that book in the show notes as well as your website. But in the meantime, I just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.